Welcome everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Milen KG2C will be your co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our own answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. In addition, we offer original articles and reviews of many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for your participants, for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange-colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can just type puzzle.kc2rc.com. In addition, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to live.kc2rc.com. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each month. All of this information can be found on our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. An application is available on our website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask our participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try my best to provide an answer, and Milen KG2C will join in. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experience to us all. If you would like to contact the hosts of this TechNet, or if you would like to submit a question for the next TechNet, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Milen KG2C. Good evening, Milen.
Good evening, Roy, and everyone else on the net. Very excited about the special topics that you have prepared for us today and for the next installment, when we'll be discussing SDR in particular. Kilogolf to Charlie, back to net.
Yes, indeed. For something different this month, we're going to do a little bit special on software-defined radio. The idea is tonight I'll do a short presentation on an overview of the topic of what software-defined radio is and what it isn't and what it means and what it doesn't mean, and I'll accept questions after it. What I'm going to try and do is have that discussion someplace in the middle of this technical net because some people do arrive late and I don't want them to miss it. So I will open up the net right now for questions from anyone listening. So please, if anyone has a question for the technical net tonight, please give us your call sign and your name. And one of these days I will get that cricket sound effect, even though it's questionable about how the FCC feels about such things. But I will get it for us because we seem to need it. Once again, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra Roy with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. Does anyone have any questions tonight?
Well, I can give you that sound effect.
Well, thank you. I would rather have participation, but I'll settle for the sound effect.
This is KD2KLN. I do not have any questions because I don't know a lot about SDR yet, other than the fact that they exist, and I haven't yet paired the right software to the darn little dongle that I've managed to get off of Amazon. So maybe we could talk about that.
Anything to do with software-defined radio at first and give a little bit of a chance for people to wander into the net, and then after the presentation on the topic, then we'll take questions about software-defined radio. You have any questions about anything other than software-defined radio?
Hello, Delta 2, Mike Lima, Yankee.
Yes, hello, Mike Lima Yankee. How are you this fine night?
Hello, Roy. How are you, everyone on the net? This is Joe. Doing fantastic. Going a little stir crazy, Roy. You know my situation. I'm in an apartment, and I'm tired of swapping out the mono band hamsticks. And so I picked up a multi-band vertical multi-band vertical. So now I'm having an issue with grounding, and so I'm running a 60-foot counterpoise throughout the apartment. Trying that, I don't know if it's the bands or it's just not working. And or now I'm seeing if I could use the metal gate as a ground without the counterpoise. Your thoughts?
Well,
one more thing, Roy.
Grounding is concerned. Grounding serves multiple purposes. It's different if you want to get lightning protection or if you just want your antenna to work better. Some people actually use something called an artificial ground for a counterpoise. If they can't get something long enough, MFJ sells it. It's basically a tuned circuit that takes the place of a counterpoise. It's not as good as a true quarter wavelength piece of metal going in some direction, but some people find it very useful. Have you considered that?
Yes, I have. Actually, I came across the same advice on a few articles and a couple of different books regarding stealth operation. That came up, actually, in two different books, funny, with the same picture of the same MFJ artificial ground unit. I thought about that, but then another question I had regarding that is, and I didn't look it up on MFJ, I meant to, but since I have you on the other line, those were very old books, and I was wondering if maybe that was an old technology. But rather than going out and purchasing that, I thought about grounding it to the metal gate. When I said metal gate, I just wanted you to know that it was the gate that supports someone from going over on the terrace, on the balcony, 18 stories up. So, and that's pretty large and pretty sturdy and steel. So, you know, maybe grinding off some of the paint on where it would be mounted would act as a really good ground. I don't know. I may have missed the first portion of your feedback on that. What do you think?
Well, you know, if you have it available, you might as well try it. And I do agree, you scrape the paint off because you have to get the bare metal to make a contact. Steel is somewhat resistive. It's not as conductive as either aluminum or certainly copper. So it's not as good as those metals, but it might do. And if you have enough of it, it might serve the purpose. Theoretically, a counterpoise should be approximately a quarter wavelength in length. It's working as a kind of the other side of the antenna, because think of your antenna as pulling and pushing, and a dipole, one end pulls, the other end pushes. If you only have one half, it doesn't really work very well if there's no one on the other side. So the counterpoise acts sort of as the other leg of the dipole. So the more metal that you have, the better it is. So I would give it a try because it wouldn't cost you anything, and they work. It may work.
Gotcha, Roy. Thanks. And another thing, right, so the counterpoise wires should be cut at a quarter wavelength for each of the bands. So, you know, would one long counterpoise for the lowest band that I'd like to work, and then I guess all the other bands would fit into there, the quarter wavelengths would fit into there, would one long counterpoise work for all of those bands, let's say from 10 meters to 80 meters?
Well, most people, people do all kinds of things. Sometimes the quick and dirty and easy approach is to just have one counterpoise, and that should be a quarter wavelength of the longest the wave that you're planning to use. Some people who have a little bit extra wire will actually fit separate counterpoises at a quarter wave for each of the bands or a few of the bands. It depends. I mean, is it going to have a dramatic effect? No, it would probably have a beneficial effect if you had the extra metal, but, you know, try what you got, see what happens, and then go from there. As I always say, these things are a process, and you're always trying to get something better and better as time goes on.
Copy that, KD2MLY. One other question, Roy? So another alternative that I'm looking at eventually would be, building my own antennas, and one in particular would be a loop antenna, and using the circumference of the terrace wall on the outside, and that's roughly around 16 feet in width by 8 feet high, and I would be using the frame of the window down to the floor of the terrace. So it would be not round and not exactly square, but rectangular, and going around the circumference of the window down to the floor of the terrace. But part of the window frame is aluminum. Would that affect the way the magnetic loop would function?
Well, depending upon the different sizes, it may or it may not. If you could move it farther away, or better yet, if you could kind of rotate it 90 degrees, you could offset any kind of effect that way. So I didn't quite realize at the beginning that you were talking about a magnetically shielded mag loop antenna. Are you planning to build one yourself? Are you planning to buy one? What's the plan?
Baylin, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you to clarify. Are you talking about a magnetic loop antenna, which is traditionally defined as having less than one-tenth of the wavelength for the band that you're operating on, or are you talking about what's called a long wire loop antenna or full wavelength loop antenna, which is a very different kind of antenna? Because when you started with 16 feet, it sounded like you're talking more about the second kind of antenna, but then you mentioned magnetic loop. So you need to make clear which kind of antenna you're talking about, because they do have different patterns, they work differently, although you wouldn't want either antenna right next to any other metal anyway. So back to you from Kilgrove to Charlie.
Okay, so I'm not quite sure what kind of loop it is. I'm getting it from this book, Stealth Amateur Radio, Operate from Anywhere. It's by Kirk A. Kleinschmidt, November Tango Oscar Zulu. And it's an older book, but it's called, it's in Chapter 5, it's called Indoor Loops and Dipoles. So, you know, he talks about using the space that you have in the circumference of a wall, and then wrapping the wire around the width of the wall. So in this case, I'd be using the outside wall of the terrace. I'd be wrapping. So I would stick like drill a hole and put like a piece of wood sticking out in all four corners, and then wrapping the wire around it at least 3 or 4 times. It says here, use 6 to 8 turns of number 16 or larger wire, which is insulated for high voltages. No spacing between turns. Use a total of 70, 90 feet of wire. Over.
Okay, so it seems to be a helical loop. Malen, you're our loop guy. Did you ever have any experience with helical loops?
No, not really. I mean, I understand what he's talking about, but I have only tried horizontal full wavelength loops, and I was very happy actually with how that worked. You mentioned the terrace, So Terrace is a good thing, by the way, because it does give you more options than what I guess they were suggesting in the book for the indoor idea of that antenna. Because indoor, it sounds like they were trying to maximize the space being used, and they knew they're going to have interference from obstructions anyway. With a terrace, you have the advantage that you can avoid some of the obstructions. So it opens you to, if you're high enough with that terrace, you could have wire hanging from it. If you don't have anything above you on the terrace, you could have the vertical antenna or on it. If you do have obstructions above and below, you could have an actual magnetic loop that you rotate, and that will give you some directional gain, which is always nice. And you could also try what was described in the book. I mean, I haven't tried it myself, so I don't know how well it will work. But wire is not very expensive, so if you can do that and you have the time to do that and compare with other stuff, it's better. What I've learned about compromise antennas, it's nice to have several different compromises to compare, because you could be surprised what will work in your situation, because these compromises are very unique depending on how you install them and what your operating position is. Kilo Golf to Charlie, back to net.
AC2GS. Well, I agree with Milan that wire is very inexpensive, so unless it's really difficult to set it up, I would suggest you set it up as an experiment. I would not be incredibly optimistic, because helical coil loop antennas are a rather rare thing, and it strikes me that it's sort of a halfway thing to a full wave loop versus a magnetic loop. Those things usually have very weird radiation patterns, and I can't tell you how easy it is going to be to tune it to 50 ohms of nominal impedance. I think, you know, what the hell, you might as well experiment. I would, again, caution you about getting it very close to any of the aluminum in your window and such, because something like that could rather easily inductively couple itself and either detune it or dissipate a lot of the RF into heat. So you should try and figure out a way to get it as far away or at a different angle where it might not couple inductively.
Understood. Thank you. And also attached to that, to continue with that, it's using 70, 90 feet at 6 to 8 turns, it's attached to an autocoupler. An autocoupler, is that the same as an antenna tuner?
That's a good question. My guess would be it's some variable impedance matching device, which is another way of saying an antenna tuner. Is that an English publication?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay, they talk a little different than us, but for all intents and purposes, they mean an antenna tuner.
Okay, excellent. So, you know, those are the projects that I'm, that's kind of like what I was focusing on right now for most of the day today. And thanks for taking the questions.
Well, you're certainly welcome, Joe. Anytime we're here, just give us a yell, and we wish you luck. Things like that, you might be able to get decent action in, say, 10 meters and 20 meters and between. When you start to get to 40 and to 80, I think the size is going to have an impact. But, you know, since as I said and Malen said, you know, wire is cheap, you might as well experiment. If anything, you'll learn something from the experience.
Gotcha. Well, I just recently picked up a multi-band vertical. It's not very, very high, because, of course, it can't be seen from the people who live above, and I can't hang a wire down because people below shouldn't be able to see it as well. But for the first time today, I was able to at least, I didn't make any contacts, but I listened in on 40 and 40, 80, and actually 160 meters. So I thought that was pretty cool, but I couldn't get anyone to hear me. So I guess little by little.
AC2GS. Yeah, it's a process, and you build up little by little. You build up experience, you build up what works for you and what doesn't work for you, and things generally get better over time. As far as a counterpoise that you can't just hang loose because it will dangle in front of other people's windows, have you considered maybe strapping it slightly to the side where it will run down the length of the building between the windows so that for the most part people won't have the faintest idea what it is, and worst comes to worst, you could tell them it's your cable wire?
Actually, I have thought of that. I would just have to, drill a small hole into, I guess, the mortar of the brick alongside in between the windows, and then I guess screw like a loop nut in there, and or a hook or something, and just kind of like hook it around there, and then guide it down. But I have thought of that. There are consequences for even such a small little hole in the facade of the building. I thought about it, yes, and I may actually give that a shot. And if so, I guess it would at least a 60-foot run would probably be a good length, or if not longer.
Yeah, that would be a good length.
Yeah, I'm contemplating on working on trying that as well. Right now, I actually have it run around the baseboard of the apartment, and it's actually going into about three different rooms, and pretty interesting. I saw that in a book as well. I said, let me give it a try.
Yeah, sometimes you can get away with it, sometimes you can't. There's a lot of factors, unfortunately, that get involved. The amount of metal in your walls has a great impact. And although, you know, a lot of places don't have large steel superstructures, they have a lot of electrical conduits that are shielded in metal that work against trying to radiate RF around them. So, you know, you give it a try. Outside's usually better than inside. High is usually better than low. The unfortunate reality is the compromises for apartment houses usually work better for UHF and VHF than they do for HF, just because of the size of the radiators involved. But if you keep plucking away at it, eventually you'll find something that gets out. Every so often we'll have a conversation with someone who has an indoor antenna that I can't imagine how I'm talking to them, but yet I do. So where there's a will, there's a way.
Gotcha. And all right, I'll keep all that in mind, and I'll keep you informed to let you know what type of what kind of success I have. This is KD2MLY. Back to net.
Okay, very good, Joe. I wish you luck. So this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, Roy here, and does anyone have any further questions for the technical net tonight? Please, if you do, give us your call sign.
Kilo Delta 2, Mike Sierra Uniform, Howie in Coney Island.
Hello, Howie. How are you this fine night? Any questions for the technical net tonight?
It's not a personal question. Looks like you have 18 story men tonight. I'm on the same floor he is. Actually, I'm like 19. But anyway, I don't have a personal question. It's about a vertical antenna. Why do they tell you sometimes to cut a little piece off? And how would that differ from loosening the hex nut and moving it up and down a small amount? Why cut it and ruin it when moving it up and down accomplished the same thing?
I think it depends upon the mechanics of the vertical antenna that's being talked about. Some antennas have an adjustable nature. You can tighten up a nut and pull up a little excess wire. But there are vertical antennas out there that are simply designed for a specific length, and there's no way that you can adjust it other than snipping it someplace. So it really depends upon the design of the vertical antenna.
In other words, you're saying you would get the same result, because once you cut it, you've ruined it. You can't put it back. It would make a discontinuity, and it wouldn't work.
Yes. Again, some vertical antennas have a adjustable length. I have a Serio 2016, which is designed, I guess, for 11 meters of citizens band. But the final portion of the vertical antenna can be dropped down into a little bevel, and you can change the length and shorten it. And by shortening it, you increase the frequency that its resonant is all the way from 11 meters to 10 meters. But again, there are some antennas that aren't designed for any of that, that you either have to bend them over, which a lot of times people suggest as far as wire dipoles. Rather than shorten the wire dipole by cutting it, it's probably best to fold it over and bend it, because then you could always bend it back if you need to. So it depends on the design of the antenna. It's always best to do an irreversible change in length if it's possible, but if it's not possible, then you're sort of stuck.
Okay, I got it. Thank you, KD2MSU.
You're welcome, Howie. Everyone keep in mind that we have a technical puzzle, as we always do. It's, type in on your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com, or the front page has the link to the puzzle, and it's a relatively simple circuit diagram, some inductors, some capacitors, and see if you could recognize what type of a filter that is. That's for later on tonight. So I'll throw out one more request for questions. If you have any questions for the technical net tonight, please give us your call sign.
Gio Yankee 2, Michael Yankee.
Recognized. Any questions for tonight, Gene?
Hey, Roy. This game, like the alpha antenna, there's just sort of like the dipole antenna. Why can't you just cut your own wire and make it? Is there any difference buying it or making it?
No, there should be no difference if you use the reasonably similar quality materials. The only thing that you benefit, I guess, by buying it from Alpha Delta is they have some lightning protection built in to the centerpiece, and it's pre-measured length. But if you feel comfortable measuring your own length, there's nothing particularly special about it. You can buy a mount for the centerpiece. You could buy some plastic offsets for where the wires attach to either side, and you can build your own fine fan dipole, and many people have.
So you buy a fan dipole, is it pre-tuned or you gotta tune it?
Usually it's not really fully completed, it's more of a kit. If you get an Alpha Delta, you'll get a big bag. It has the wires pre-cut to a certain length, but the offsets haven't been added. You have to place the offsets throughout the length of the fan dipole so that it hangs together. And the length is a preliminary approximation that the pamphlet that comes with it suggests that you can fine-tune it by shortening it a little bit if you need to. It's more difficult to lengthen it, but they suggest that you try it out, see what kind of resonance you get, and if you don't like it and you want to shorten it, to bend it back a little bit to tune it to a slightly different, slightly higher frequency resonance.
In other words, you do need an antenna analyzer.
That would be incredibly useful. Theoretically, you don't have to. Theoretically, you can use the SWR meter on your radio and figure out what you can tune to and what you can't tune to with your antenna tuner and judge accordingly. It is markedly easier if you just sweep it with an antenna analyzer.
Okay. Have you ever heard the Comet one, the Comet CA8500? What do you think about that one?
KC2GS. It's a nice one. I remember the first model that they came out with, which just had a meter movement. It was very analog. The second generation is much prettier. It has an LCD screen with some imagery and can do a sweep, I think. I tend to prefer the Rig Expert ones. They make a full line of them at different bandwidths, and they are much more flexible than that model. But I haven't heard anything terrible about that model. Most of the time, if you ask someone what kind of an antenna tuner analyzer they have, they sort of immediately tell you MFJ, because MFJ has been in that business and selling inexpensive ones for so many years that most hams have one of those in the closet someplace. But the one you're looking at, I've heard good things. I haven't looked them up in eHam. You might want to do that. But I tend to like the Rig Expert models a little bit better.
Yeah, the Rig Model Expert is like almost a little more than double, little less than double the cost of the Comet one. They're probably close in range with the MFJ 269C.
Yeah, yeah. The going thing with MFJ has a lot of different models of everything, and they're very inexpensive. The price you tend to pay is the quality control issues, but if you like rattling boxes and soldering cold solder joints, then you could save yourself a couple of bucks. Again, the Comet looks nice. I haven't known anyone who actually owns one for some reason. I don't know. But probably a quick visit to eHam would get you a good idea of what the general sensibilities of that model are. I haven't heard anything bad about it.
Okay, I guess I did some research. It popped up. Oh, let me look at that one. It's a different option, but I really haven't looked into it yet.
Yes, there's that option, and then there's a lot of different companies that make something that they call a vector network analyzer, a VNA, which effectively is an antenna analyzer. It has more bells and whistles. The Rig Experts are actually VNAs. I'm not quite sure if the Comet qualifies as a VNA. MFJ antenna analyzers, some of them are VNAs and some of them aren't. It depends on how many things it can do. If it can do time delay refractometry and also give you the impedance, whether it's inductive or capacitive. A lot of MFJ equipment will tell you when you're off impedance, but it won't quite indicate whether it's an inductive impedance or a capacitive impedance, and you have to kind of figure that out for yourself.
Okay, I understand.
Okay, Gene, any other questions or comments at this time?
Oh, I'm good. Thank you, Roy. Q Yankee 2, Michael Yankee.
Okay, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, and I'm going to try this out and to see if I can say this stuff without timing out the repeater. I'm not quite sure what the timeout interval is, but hopefully someone will let me know if I've triggered it. The talk for tonight is software-defined radio. This is an overview. Hopefully, if there's an interest, the next time I'm on, we'll talk about the technical aspects of what the circuit diagrams sort of look like and what they do. First thing I'd like to mention is what software-defined radio isn't, because there's a lot of confusion. Software-defined radio is not software-controlled radios. It's not internet-based radios. It's not internet simulations of radios. It's not digital signal processors in the final portion of radios. It's not digital mode-capable radios. It's not analog radios with an IF output that feeds the pan adapter, although pan adapters are cute. There's no heterodyning. There's no regenerating. There's none of that. There's no real discrete LC components beyond the front end of the radio. Let me drop. Software-defined radio is a radio communication system where components that have been traditionally implemented in hardware, like mixers, filters, amplifiers, modulators, demodulators, detectors, are instead implemented by means of software on a personal computer or embedded system. In its ultimate form, it would be a wire antenna tied directly to a digital-to-analog converter, or an analog-digital converter in that case, with all aspects of the signal operating on digital bits and bytes, on slabs of high-tech silicon solid-state devices. The current state-of-the-art does not yet allow for this purist approach, but we are getting closer and closer to that. All of those analog RF circuits are replaced by digital analog converters, central processing units, reduced instruction set computer chips, and a fun thing called a field programmable gate array, which is like a programmable central processing unit. It's like your Intel chip if you could teach it how to do specific things much faster. There are different generations. Back in the turn of the century, there was the first generation, but now we're on the third and the fourth generation. And as the generations progress, what's happening is the digital chain is beginning closer and closer to the antenna feed. Software-defined radio started with our good old military, who had a lot of money to spend on the research and development, fortunately. The first amateur radio awareness of software-defined radio was pretty much a guy named Gerald Youngblood, K5SDR, who was writing a whole bunch of articles in QEX, which is a technical journal that the ARRL publishes. And he was writing about the development of his new toy, which he christened the SDR-1000. And there was so much interest and demand that he started to sell kits, and he started the Flex Radio System, which now sells radios to this day. He also developed software for that little system, something called PowerSDR, which he left, thankfully, as an open-source program and has been used repeatedly by other people to get all kinds of software-defined radios to work. What soon followed was an organization called the Tucson Amateur Packet Radio Organization, which originated back in 82 to build and sell kits for packet radio terminal nodes. I don't know if anyone remembers those days, but it was kind of an early radio experiment of mimicking the packet transmissions of the Internet. Anyway, Tapper went on their merry way and got bored with packet radio, but didn't change their name. They decided to develop something in software-defined radio. They decided to use the same method of just designing kits and selling kits. And so they came up with all these interesting subboards. There was a penny whistle, which is an RF power amplifier. There was a circuit board called Metis, which is a high-speed computer interface. And instead of having one transceiver, they would come out with a different subboard that, if you plug them all together, would make a very nice software-defined radio. Eventually, everyone kind of noticed that there aren't that many people who like to build kits. So a couple of guys in India called Apache Labs got together with the guys in Taper, and they said, look, we'll build the darn things. You tell us the design specifications. You maintain the software. And we'll sell them in a box where no one has to solder a thing. And so that is the Anon radios that many people hear about. And if you go down to some HF fans, especially 40, you will end up bumping into a lot of people who are tweaking the software settings of their Anon radios. But that's all designed by Tucson amateur packet radio guys. Very smart guys, but, you know, if they ever get bored and stop upgrading the software, everyone's stuck because Apache Labs just sells finished products. They don't really do any research and development. And as I mentioned before, with Gerald Youngblood, he founded the Flex Radio System. They've gone on to be reasonably successful, started on with the SDR-100, then went to the SDR-500 and the 5000 and the 3000, which was an intermediate price version, and the 1500, which was a QRP low power version. And then a few years ago, moved on to a third generation SDR called the 6000 series. In addition, there's a whole other technology that involves European television called the digital HDTV or DVB-T TV. Millions and millions of people needed a decoder for their televisions in Europe, and so they developed a chip, and since they sold it to millions, the price per chip was next to nothing. And the chip that they used for this experience was called the RTL2832U. Some bright guy figured out that if he wrote a little bit of software and plugged that thing into his computer, he could actually listen to broadcast to amateur FM radio signals. And since then, there's been a small cottage industry of RTL SDRs. For as little as $20, you could buy one of these things on eBay or even Amazon, plug it in, and run some software, and you can experience software-defined radio. Is it the best software-defined radio? Not really. It's receive-only. There's no transmitting. It's not very good for HF, since it was designed to pick up television broadcasts. It's much better on the UHF and VHF bands, although there are some people who include a up converter as part of it, and that way you can listen to the whole band. So there's a lot of different options for RTL, and it's very inexpensive. Also, you have to keep in mind that Elecraft entered the SDR market years ago in a very stealthy way. Most people don't realize it, but the KX3 and the KX2 are kind of cloaked SDR devices. Inside their SDR, they happen to not show it. There's no real computer interface for it. It's all controlled on the top of the box, but it is an SDR. So if someone is using a KX3 or a KX2, you're doing SDR. Now, just to give you a vague idea of how many pieces of software run something like RTL SDR, I'll just recite a few for you, and this is only a few. There's SDR Sharp, there's HD SDR, there's SDR Radio, there's Linrad, there's GQRX, there's Cubic SDR, there's Studio One, there's SDR Uno, there's Shiny SDR, there's Web Radio, there's Open Web RX, and it goes on and on and on. And then, of course, there's ICOM that's joined the party. There's the ICOM 7300, which has been incredibly popular. Almost every other person I talk to on HF seems to have just bought a 7300. And ICOM has just released their ICOM 7610 radio, which I'm not quite sure it's going to be quite as popular, but it'll be interesting to see. There are a whole bunch of receivers, Perseus receivers, ELAD, SDR Play, Win Radio, AOR, Calibri Nano. There are other transceivers. Sun SDR and ELAD has a transceiver that's an SDR. There's a bunch of pluses and there's a bunch of minuses. The pluses are that the silicon is always getting cheaper and faster, that programming, the programmer's imagination is the only real limit in many ways, that every firmware update can be like buying a new radio, that with smart enough algorithms and powerful enough silicon, analog circuit limits melt away. Sharp filters that don't ring, programming new modulation modes, all manner of things. There's no mixers, there's no local oscillators, there's no roofing filters required, there's no added noise or distortion between the analog to digital converter at the front end and the digital to analog converter at the audio circuit end. And IMD is reduced at a relatively low cost, and there's the future of something called pre-distortion capability, in which a feedback mechanism will lower the IMD distortion even more than the SDR by itself. There's less need for calibration, and it could be done on software. They're usually smaller and lighter with less discrete components than the old legacy radios. And your S-meter actually gives you an accurate number rather than the random number that the average legacy radio produces. The minuses are that when the last software developer quits, you're really stuck because it's all in software. And software development takes either a lot of love for the project or a lot of money. And that's about it. Software-defined radio, to me, this is the future. It's not a matter of whether or not it will be the future. It's just a matter of when it will become the future. So that's my little synopsis overview on software-defined radio. I hope people found it interesting, and hopefully, if there's enough interest, we'll do a more technical review of the circuit blocks and logic that goes into making it work. But I will open the net to questions on the subject, if there are any.
KD2MSU.
Yes, Howie.
I'm just curious, has this ignited a controversy such as we had between Vinyl Records and the CD among hams who favor the old standard analog radio?
Yes. Yeah, well, any change is resisted by some and jumped on by others. I tend to be the guy who likes to live on the bleeding edge as far as technology. On the flip side, there are guys who don't use any radio equipment that was built after 1950. I still believe that if the FCC didn't make it illegal to use spark gap transmitters, there would be a whole bunch of guys probably trying to listen to each other on 80 meters or 160 meters that only were using a spark gap. But yes, there are guys who love this technology. There are guys who loathe this technology. I remember talking to one such gentleman who looked at me and said that the only way to find a weak signal is with your ears and a tuning knob.
I bet those other people are still trying to pick up the Titanic's SOS CQD.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all. I actually heard CQD the other day. I was watching, I don't know if anyone watches British television. There's something called QI, which I think means quite interesting. And one of their trivia questions, they played a sound that was Morse code for CQD. And they kind of got into the subject of Morse code, which they said was not invented by Morse and wasn't actually a code. It was more properly a cipher.
Yeah, I think I've heard that argument. And, you know, the call sign for the Titanic was MGY, and the M stood for Marconi, meaning they had a Marconi radio as opposed to a W for Westinghouse radio.
I think up until that time, there was no particular law or rule that you had to have a radio on the ship. But after that disaster, they passed some law that you didn't have a choice. If you were above a certain size or had a certain number of people that you were carrying, you had to have communication.
That's true. I think it went by the tonnage. And the SOS, I think, had been agreed on in 1907. But the CQD was for British ships. They were actually asking for help initially from another British ship.
Yeah, it's sort of amazing disasters that never kind of get put to bed. We keep pulling that out. Well, you know, we have guys who direct movies and make billions of dollars off of the subject, so I can sort of understand it. But it seems to continue to fascinate people. You know, there's a few little upticks or downticks in history that just people won't put to bed. It's just they relive it. And, you know, was the captain inebriated? What was his condition? Why did he do the things he did? It's one of those things that you never kind of give up on.
David Sarnoff made his money from that. I think he was one of the operators here who heard the signal, heard the SOS here in the United States. I think he was the first one in the Wanamaker where he was working. And I guess he was involved in radio early on.
KC2GA. Yeah, that's where he made his name and fame. He apparently had a very good ear for Morse code, but probably incredibly much more important was he just had great business skills, because most guys would just get their name in newspaper and that would be the end of it. But General Sarnoff milked that all it was worth, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Okay, in Marconi had a radio station at the tip of Coney Island in Seagate back in the turn of the century, like 1900, about.
Yeah, well, I mean, in general, Long Island has a very long history with aviation and radio communications, and good old Tesla had his strange device parked there someplace in Long Island as well. So, you know, I mean, we kind of forget how famous Long Island was back then. Now it's just a kind of a residence for people who for the most part, live in Manhattan, work in Manhattan.
A long parking lot. Okay, I think we better move on. KD2MSU.
Okay, does anyone else have any either questions, comments, statements, or disagreements about software-defined radio?
Kilo Golf to Charlie with a question.
Yes, Milan.
Can you tell us a little more about the generations of software-defined radio? You mentioned that we're currently in the third generation with the Flex 6000. I'm pretty sure the second generation would be the Flex 5000 series as an example, radios that do the sound processing using a computer, and the third generation being radios that do it within the radio itself. And what would be the first generation as well? Back to you.
The actual technical aspects. The first generation used an actual detector. It allowed for a lot of legacy and radio blocks in the schematic. It had RF amplifiers, it had IF stages with mixers and local oscillators, and eventually the final IF, rather than feeding into a demodulator, would feed into something called a Taylor detector, which would separate out the signal and the quadrature aspect of the signal, and that would be fed into two digitizers. So you would have the so-called I and Q signals. Once you had the digitized I and Q signals of the IF stage, you could then manipulate them and either filter or demodulate them in software. That software could take place in the radio, but almost always it ended up having to take place in the personal computer because the old SDR radios had no power to do any of that. So what you would have from the SDR is two little plugs coming out to the sound card, one giving you an I, one giving you a Q. That would be the quadrature delayed signal in a digitized mode, and all the modulation and filtering would take place in your personal computer. That was the first generation, and that was the SDR 1000. That's the way it worked. The 5000 had a lot more processing that took place in it, and over time, the stage that was digitalized has gone further and further back. There was, right now it's called direct sampling, in which it's feeding right from the antenna feed. There was an intermediate in the second generation where they called it a zero IF. What happened is there was a single IF stage that mixed down to a level that the analog to digital converters could tolerate back then. And so it was kind of a first IF stage radio was the second generation. The third generation has a direct sampling. So it's a combination of where the processing goes on and where the digitalization occurs.
Okay, thank you. So following this hierarchy or categorization, which generation would be the SDR Play RSP1 Alpha receiver? Would that be third generation or second generation? Because they keep using that technology for a local oscillator, but I'm not sure there is actually something like that. I think it's just the center frequency for the bandwidth that you're looking at there. And it, to me, it looks like direct conversion. but I actually haven't read the technical specs enough to understand which generation it is.
Well, I mean, I haven't checked either. My guesstimate would be that it's a second generation because it's a lot easier to do. And matter of fact, all the non-radios, as much as powerful as they are, have an intermediate frequency in them, so they're second generation as well. So there's a lot that you can do with a second generation. It's not crippled in any way. So my guess would be it's second, but I could be wrong.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome, Milan. Any other questions about software-defined radios out there?
KP2 JSP.
JSP, what can I do for you?
Sure, if I have a question, I just want to thank you for the presentation. My wife and I both worked in the DoD sector developing JTRS, JTRS software-defined radio. Not the most successful DoD program ever, but it was very interesting. We both became ham radio people following that. So we're looking forward to the development of ham radio, pure SDR in the ham radio sector as well.
Oh, very good. I think we're kind of almost there. It's at this point the third generation designs. Well, the latest designs require a bandpass filter and some preamp that are legacy, that are regular components. But beyond that point, it's all digital. So. You know, this is a brave new world we're living in. The only beauty is that as time goes on, the silicon's going to get cheaper and faster, and the bandwidth is probably going to get wider and wider. I mean, my Flex 6700 can work all the way up to 2 meters, although it plays a little game by switching an anti-aliasing antenna setting and doubles the frequency set. But eventually, it's going to run, you know, like many people describe, DC to light.
And we're looking forward to that day. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other statements, comments, questions, or whatever for the technical net before we get to the puzzle? I hope someone wants to play with the puzzle tonight.
Hey, Roy, a quick comment.
Sure, Milan.
You mentioned DC to light. There is actually a very interesting characteristic of the RSP-1 Alpha that they say it covers 1 kilohertz through 2 gigahertz. Now, it doesn't cover them perfectly. They obviously such high bandwidth. You cannot listen to it all at once. And there are some compromises made to accommodate that. But you can listen to signals all across those bands, which is pretty impressive, and it does use bandpass filters. It has different bandpass filters. It has some notch filters for FM and for digital TV stations and things like that. Back to you from Kilo Golf to Charlie.
Yeah, the state of the art with digital to analog converters is that you have to use stuff like that to clean up the background mess. Otherwise, it's very easy to overload the analog to digital converter, and then you get a lot of noise in your data stream, and it can be a mess. Well, it depends on the criteria you use for the frequency range. You can go past the recommended frequency range at the cost of getting a lower dynamic range and digital resolution. There are tricks that we'll go into next time called decimation, to get back some of the resolution, but you can play that game only so much. And then the question really comes down to what's an acceptable dynamic range. That pretty much puts a limit on how high and how low you can do something useful with it. So I can sort of understand the 2 gigahertz, although I'm sure the dynamic range at 2 gigahertz is not the same at 100 megahertz.
Yeah, they did say that, and they have graphs showing some of these things.
Yeah, you know, it goes back to the old phrase, there's no such thing as a free lunch. You have to pay for it somewhere. But eventually, as I said before, until we hit some kind of terrible wall or ceiling, things will just get faster and cheaper. So there'll come a time that you'll be able to put most of the guts of a radio into a small bunch of chips the size of a iPhone. And I don't know if that's going to be a fun thing or a disappointing thing. And I don't know if I'm going to last long enough to quite see it go that small. So, you know, the future is going to be interesting out there. Any other questions or comments about software-defined radio for tonight? Okay, once again, hopefully next time I will do a more technical discussion of what the components are from the antenna to the audio amplifier stage and give you a somewhat better idea of how the magic works. But until then, does anyone want to play the TechNet puzzle tonight? It's a circuit. It's on the website. It's basically two capacitors and two inductors. And the question amounts to, what kind of a filter could it possibly be? Any takers?
KD2MLY, or give it a shot?
Sure, give it a shot.
I'm going to say the answer is D, stop frequencies above and below the cutoff of frequency.
Okay, so what that means is it's a, if that was the case, it would be a low bandwidth bandpass filter. It would be a tuned network with the LC circuit determining the highest peak where the frequency would get past the most. Those are the type of filters one tends to see in a duplexer. They're seen in oscillators because the feedback loop goes through those types of filters so that the oscillating frequency is on frequency. The trouble with that is they usually either have a capacitor and inductor parallel to each other or in series with each other as a tuned circuit. And if you'll notice, there's none of that going on there with this circuit. This circuit has a capacitor in series with high and ground and a parallel connections rounding out the circuit with an inductor before the capacitors and after the capacitors. So any further thoughts on what your second answer might be?
Well, with that in mind, and this would be, of course, this is now a complete guess.
You're both to Charlie?
Yes, Milan.
Well, to me, that looks like a bisection, most of it, except I'm not sure about the capacitor below. So the rest of it looks like the bisection of a high-pass filter. But I really don't know how that capacitor at the bottom changes things.
Well, the bottom kind of just does a little bit more. It allows for a balanced signal. You can have a filter that's balanced or unbalanced. This particular filter is a balanced filter, and so that's why it has a mirror image for each other. But, you know, you're basically saying the right thing. When you have capacitors in series and inductors in parallel, it's usually a high filter because high frequencies are conducted through capacitors, especially when they're connected serially, and low current is grounded and shorted out when the frequency is low. So if you had something ridiculous like a gigahertz signal, it would go right through the capacitors, but it would be blocked by the inductors, and so it would be a straight line. If it was a 60-cycle hum, it would be blocked by the capacitor because a 60-cycle signal doesn't really pass very well through a capacitor, but it would bleed right through the inductor and short out. So, yeah, it's basically a high-pass filter. If the series circuits were inductors and the parallel circuits were capacitors, it would be a low-pass filter. And as I said before, if it was either a notch filter or a low bandwidth filter, which were the other two options, there would be a series of either parallel inductor capacitors or serial capacitor inductors acting as separate tuning networks, and they'd either short things out if they were notching, or they would be in serial connections, and that would give you a nice peak short bandwidth bandpass filter. So the bottom line is the answer is D. Pass frequencies above the cutoff point of this circuit. It's a high-pass filter. So just remember to kind of look to see what the components are. If the components going in series is a capacitor, it's usually passing high frequency. If the component going in series is an inductor, it's usually passing low frequency. Any questions from anyone about this? Very well. Any further questions or comments for the technical net for tonight? Very well. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting, which will be January 3rd, we have a pre-meeting from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m., but the general meeting begins somewhere close to 8 o'clock and lasts until about 9:30 to 10. Let's see. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m. We have weekly nets featuring Yaesu Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday at 9 p.m. on our club repeater, KC2RC. If you have the ability to communicate using Fusion technology, please join in. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when fellow members join our club. Keep in mind that an application is available on our website. If you would like to contact the hosts of this TechNet, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this TechNet, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Well, it's time to roll this all up and shut this all down. We will be back December 27th to do this all over again. And if I don't speak to you until then, I wish you all a Merry Christmas and a Happy Chinooka, and have a great time. So this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Night, guys.
Thank you, Roy. Good night. Very good job. 7-3 from Kilo Golf to Charlie.
Thank you, Roy. Thank you, Merlin. Kilo Yankee 2, Michael Yankee, signing out.
Good night from Kilo Delta 2, Mike Sierra Uniform.
Thanks, Roy. KC2, WTA, Jones, Staten Island.
Thanks, Roy. Thanks, Malin. KD2, NOI, clear.
W2TJ, Bay.